Hello, this is your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, bringing you the January 6, 2025 edition of the New Yorker magazine. Today's main story is How Much Does Our Language Shape Our Thinking? By Manveer Singh. Annals of Inquiry: How Much Does Our Language Shape Our Thinking? English continues to expand into diverse regions around the world. The question is whether humanity will be homogenized as a result. By Manveer Singh. In 2010, a new goddess, about 2 feet tall and cast in bronze, was set to appear in a village within the Indian state of Uttar Pradesh. She looked nothing like the deities of Hindu mythology. In lieu of Durga's bright saris or Lakshmi's opulent jewels, she wore a wide-brimmed hat and the robes of the Statue of Liberty. She wasn't riding a lion or a swan. She stood on a desktop computer. Instead of a sword or a spear, she held a pen in one hand, and the Indian Constitution, with its promise of legalized equality, in the other. Her name was Angrezi Devi, the goddess of English, and she was intended for India's Dalits or untouchables. The goddess English can empower Dalits, giving them a chance to break free from centuries of oppression. Her creator, the prominent Dalit writer Chandra Ban Prasad, declared. He saw English as an immensely valuable resource for the Dalit. Will English-speaking Dalits be expected to clean gutters and roads, he asked. Will English-speaking Dalits be content to work as menials at landlords' farms? An atheist, he designed the goddess in order to infuse English into the Dalit identity, propelling his people from a feudal subaltern standing to the ranks of the modern and independent. Learning English has become the greatest mass movement the world has ever seen, he wrote. He had a point. An estimated 1.5 billion people, roughly one in every five human beings, speak English, making it the most widely used language in the history of humanity. With an official status in the UN, NATO, the WTO, and the EU, it reigns as the dominant lingua franca of the world. Rosemary Salome writes in The Rise of English, Global Politics and the Power of Language, Oxford. Like other colonial tongues, it spread first through conquest, conversion, and commerce, she notes. But its spread today is powered by a fourth process, what Salome calls collusion. Around the globe, people pursue English and the opportunities it promises. Korean mothers move their children to Anglophone countries to learn in English, Salome observes. Dutch universities teach in it. Asian countries collaborate in it. Political activists tweet in it. The expansion of English naturally evokes angst and opposition. Salome, a law professor at St. John's University, focuses on the political and legal tensions that accompany the diffusion of English. France, for example, fought for decades against English's dominance in the European economic community and then in the EU. If, with the arrival of English, French no longer were the first working language in the community, the French president Georges Pompidou warned in 1971, then Europe would never be totally European. Nearly half a century later, in 2018, President Emmanuel Macron declared English to be too dominant in Brussels and vowed to ramp up efforts to teach French to European officials. In part, such apprehension reflects unease about the erosion of various cultural identities. Yet many researchers find another reason to worry about the spread of English: the prospect of cognitive hegemony. Languages, they argue, influence how we perceive and respond to the world. The idiosyncrasies of English, its grammar, its concepts, its connection to Western culture, can jointly produce an arbitrary construction of reality. Speculation about these effects is widespread. Prasad, for instance, thinks there's a kind of egalitarianism that's inherent in English and missing from its Indian alternatives. Hindi is full of caste biases, he told me. Idioms, phrases, sayings, jokes, songs belittle Dalits. How can any Dalit take pride in the so-called native tongue? Other intellectuals, such as the Kenyan writer Ngugi Wa Thiong'o, maintain that English serves as yet another tool to entrench British and American culture. Pierre Bourdieu, the celebrated French sociologist, voiced a common concern when in 2001 he wondered if it is possible to accept the use of English without the risk of one's mental structures being anglicized, without being brainwashed by linguistic patterns. Was he right to worry? Everyone can agree that languages affect thoughts. If I told you that I have a pet badger and 22 canaries, you'd have new thoughts about my home life. The real question is whether a language itself has features that affect how its speakers think. Does conversing in Spanish for a month make objects seem more gendered? Does speaking English rather than Hindi make you less casteist and maybe more capitalist? Today, questions like these tend to be associated with Benjamin Lee Whorf, a fire insurance analyst who studied linguistics at Yale in the 1930s. History has been both kind and unkind to him. On the one hand, his name has become synonymous with a theory about how language affects thought, though it predated him by at least a century. On the other hand, the version of the theory often attributed to him is so radical that few modern scholars would want the honor anyway. Whorf laid out his view in an essay titled "The Relation of Habitual Thought and Behavior to Language," contrasting the way time is discussed by English speakers as an object that can be quantified and divided, and by Hopi speakers as a more continuous process, or so Whorf believed. He suggested that linguistic differences contributed to differences in how each group understands temporal flow. Despite the boldness of his claims, he was also cautious, proposing merely traceable affinities between language and behavior, nothing ironclad, and stressing that he was the last to pretend that there is anything so definitive as a correlation. Unfortunately, that nuance has usually been forgotten. Whorf has since become the mascot of linguistic determinism, the position that language is the ultimate arbiter of thought. Whorfism, as it's sometimes called, quickly dissolves into absurdities. If your language lacks a proper future tense, tomorrow will be inconceivable. If your language lacks certain emotion words, you will never feel them. Proverbial infants, orangutans, and all other creatures incapable of language are, by implication, powerless to perform many basic mental operations. Whorfianism has been the target of relentless discrediting. Some of the most striking counterexamples involve individuals unable to produce or comprehend language. Take the case of Brother John, a 50-year-old French-Canadian who suffered from spells of aphasia. Even during periods when he had lost the faculty of language, he mostly got along fine, according to a 1980 study published in Brain and Language. He could manipulate complex tools, follow instructions he'd been given beforehand, and sometimes succeed in hiding his impairment from others. The Harvard cognitive scientist Steven Pinker has had much to say about Whorfian fallacies. He has shown how common experiences, like searching for the right word or inventing a new term for an existing intuition, invalidate the idea that languages always precedes thought. Writing in The Language Instinct, 1994, he concludes that Whorfianism is wrong, all wrong. That's a fair assessment if we're talking about the strongest interpretation of Whorf's arguments. Yet the picture emerging from the latest research is more complicated. Whorfianism is wrong, but it isn't all wrong. Each of my languages comes not only with its own patterns of sound and methods for arranging words, but also with its social habits and its judgments about what to forgive, what to condemn, and what to revere. Julie Sidivi writes in Linguophile, A Life of Language Love, Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux. Born in what was then Czechoslovakia, Sidivi grew up in a linguistic bedlam, hopping between Austria and Italy before settling down in Montreal. She was acquainted with 5 languages by kindergarten and went on to study how people learn and process language. Science suffuses her book, yet as a way of knowing, it coexists with experience. The resulting volume isn't so much a standard pop sci book as it is a rhapsodic meditation on loving, taming, and forgetting words. She senses that distinct cognitive styles are tied to the different languages she speaks, comparing them to personalities bickering for the spotlight. I am a cacophony of voices influencing each other, at times assisting each other, at times getting in each other's way, always vying for turf, she writes. Testimony from polyglots like her has invited a more sophisticated take on Worf's ideas. What if language is less like a yoke than like a wind, nudging us in various directions? This moderate approach, which is more in line with Worf's original perspective, is known as weak Worfianism, or paradoxically, neo-Worfianism. Some neo-Worfian studies have already become classics. One led by the psychologist Jonathan Winawer and published in a 2007 took advantage of the fact that where English has the word blue, Russian has 2 basic terms, guloboy, lighter blue, and sinyi, darker blue. Russian speakers in the experiment proved faster than English speakers at distinguishing shades that corresponded to that lexical distinction. Other such studies exploit variations in, for instance, how languages talk about temporal duration, long and short, as in English, or big and small, as in Greek, or the ordering of events, B following A, as in English, or B below A, as in Mandarin, testing whether those differences correlate with performance on experimental tests. Many linguists remain unimpressed. In the anti-Worfian polemic, The Language Hoax, 2014, John H. McWhorter of Columbia University describes this research as mostly showing eensy-weensy differences of the sort that one might find in the cosseted context of a psychological experiment. Caleb Everett, an anthropologist and psychologist at the University of Miami, arrives at another conclusion in A Myriad of Tongues, Harvard. Like Sedvi, Everett has reared in a morass of languages. The son of the missionary turned linguist, Daniel Everett, he spent much of his childhood in Brazil. His parents intermittently took him to the Amazon to say with a Piraa, a people legendary for speaking a language devoid of words for numbers and colors, which contributed to his lifelong fascination with linguistic and cognitive diversity. Everett's book is about the surprising ways that languages differ, about the significance these differences may have. He starts by covering Worf's favorite topic, time. English speakers instinctively split time into categories of past, present, and future, but many others don't. Catriona, an Amazonian language Everett studied 2 decades ago, has 2 tenses, future and non-future, while other Amazonian language, Yagua, seems to have 8, including for events that occurred between a month and a year ago, for events that are about to happen, and for events expected to happen further into the future. More relevant for Worfianism are the metaphors people use to organize time. For English speakers, time is understood spatially, with the past typically behind us and the future ahead. Aymara, an Andean language spoken by millions of indigenous Bolivians and Peruvians, likewise uses space to talk about time, but favors a metaphor about sight. In Aymara, Naira, or last year, translate literally to something like the year I can see. The past, visible, thus stands in front of the speaker, while the future, unseeable, looms behind. Acha, Naira, Pachana, or a long time ago, can roughly be translated as a time way in front of me. When researchers analyze videos of people chatting, they notice that the metaphors inform gesture, with fluent Aymara speakers pointing backward to talk about the future and forward to talk about the past. Spanish speakers from the same region show the opposite patterns, suggesting that language configures how speakers map time onto space. Aymara speakers are far from unique here. Speakers of Lisu, a Tibetan-Burman language, also talk about the future as lying behind them and the past as in front of them. Everett tells us that Yupno, a language spoken in the eastern New Guinea highlands, invokes a three-dimensional analogy. Like a gravity-defying river, the future is said to flow up mountains while the past flows downhill. As with Aymara speakers, the metaphor manifests in gesture. How Yupno speakers point depends on the orientation of the nearest mountain range. Some cognitive scientists have assumed that all humans, whatever their local quirks, reason about time using spatial metaphors, yet at least one language, Tupi Yahib, eventually lacks any mapping between time and space, not left to right, back to front, or downhill to uphill. When Tupi Kawahib speakers were asked to organize objects to chart out seasons of a year, researchers struggled to understand the arrangements that speakers had created. More than communication tools, languages help concretize the abstract, providing frameworks for making sense of concepts as fundamental as time. Of the many topics Everett covers, which include space, number, and object categorization, the most fascinating is probably sensory vocabulary. Western writers have long assumed that human beings have an inherently limited capacity to describe some senses, with olfaction ranking as the most elusive. We can speak abstractly about colors, red, blue, black, and sound, high, low, loud. With smell, though, we usually give source-based references, like cut grass. But the cognitive scientist Asifa Majid, now of Oxford, and the linguist Niklas Bernholt of Lund University in Sweden have shown that this needn't be the case. They discovered that the Jahai, hunter-gatherers living at the border of Malaysia and Thailand, have a rich vocabulary of abstract smell words. One Jahai term, itpit, refers to the intense smell of durian, perfume, soap, aquilaria, wood, and bearcat, Majid and Bernholt report. Another sense applies to the smell of petrol, smoke, bat droppings, and bat caves. Some species of millipede, root of wild ginger, leaf of gingerwort, wood of mango tree. Subsequent research has found large olfactory lexicons in at least 40 other languages, among them Fang, Khmer, Swahili, and Zapotec. It makes a difference. In a study that Majid and Bernholt conducted a decade ago, Jahai and English speakers were asked to identify and name 12 smells, including cinnamon, turpentine, gasoline, and onion. English speakers, despite their greater familiarity with the odors, faltered. They mostly gave rambling source-based answers and showed almost no agreement among themselves. One English speaker presented with cinnamon responded, "I don't know how to say that, sweet, yeah. I've tasted that gum like Big Red or something tastes like, what do I want to say? I can't get the word. Jesus, isn't that gum smell like something like Big Red? Can I say that? Okay, Big Red. Big Red gum." But Jahai speakers named smells with relative ease. They used abstract terms and were much more likely to converge in their responses. In a follow-up study, wine and coffee experts performed just as badly as novices when given non-wine and non-coffee smells, suggesting the Jahai's enhanced abilities aren't simply a result of practice in attending to aromas. Rather, the regular exercise of sorting the olfactory world with abstract labels seems to change how the Jahai understand all smells, familiar and otherwise. The work on olfaction is a tiny part of language research program, much of it headed by Majid, that has overturned the scientific consensus on how humans talk about the senses. At least since Aristotle, many writers have posited a sensorial hierarchy. Seeing and hearing are said to be the most salient to our minds and the easiest to verbalize, followed by taste, touch, and finally smell. Contesting that thesis, Majid and her colleagues have developed a measure called codability, which captures how easily a sense is expressed. Codability is high when members of a language community converge on one or two abstract labels to describe a stimulus. Ask English speakers to tell you the color of a stop sign, and you'd expect high codability. It's low in contrast when people provide diverse, protracted, and ad hoc descriptions, as when, say, you ask English speakers to describe the smell of a rutabaga. Majid and her team measured codability for the five senses in 20 far-flung languages, including three unrelated sign languages. English, the only spoken Western European tongue in the sample, was also the only one to exhibit high codability for sight and hearing and low codability for everything else. Rampant variation reigned, the researchers found. English speakers floundered when talking about touch in response to sandpaper, felt, rubber, etc. But speakers of certain other languages, such as Dogol Dom in Mali and Siwu in Ghana, tended to agree in their descriptions. In many languages, including Lao, Farsi, Yucatec, and Cantonese, taste turned out to be the most expressible sense. As researchers look beyond English, close relatives like Spanish and German, and other so-called behemoth languages like Mandarin and Arabic, they encounter differences long thought impossible. 20 years ago, abstract small vocabularies seemed ridiculous. Bernholtz studied the Jahai languages for a decade, even writing a doctoral dissertation on its grammar, before Majid asked him to run a battery of tests that revealed Jahai speakers' exceptional way of talking about smell. Other linguistic features, once assumed to be universal, such as tenses, personal pronouns, and even potentially a distinction between nouns and verbs, have turned up missing when greater numbers of languages have been scrutinized. Likewise, we've enlarged our sense of the metaphors used to map concepts. English describes acoustic pitch using a verticality metaphor, high-low, but a study by experts in musical cognition found that people around the world use at least 35 other mappings, such as small-big, alert-sleepy, pretty-ugly, tense-relaxed, summer wintry, and in the case of some traditional Zimbabwean instrumentalists, crocodile, low pitch, and those who follow crocodiles, high pitch. Everett's book revels in such discoveries, which multiply the conceivable differences separating languages. In a recent review of the research literature, the language scientist Damien E. Blasi, along with Majid and others, listed the many cognitive domains that English seems to affect, including memory, theory of mind, spatial reasoning, event processing, aesthetic preferences, and sensitivity to rhythm and melody. Languages help shape the worlds we inhabit less through a few grammatical rules than through countless subtle distinctions. John McWhorter might have been right that the effects of any single linguistic feature is minor, but as Isaac Newton realized when developing calculus, innumerable tiny effects create large-scale patterns. Prasad's Goddess English was meant to debut on October 25, 2010. She was supposed to inhabit a temple of black granite, its walls engraved with scientific formulas and the names of great English writers. But the big day never came. The district government blocked the temple's construction. Prasad recalls a local official hinting that the decision came from Kumari Mayawati, then the chief minister of Uttar Pradesh. Mayawati, who is herself Dalit and who had statues made in her honor while in office, enjoys an almost mythical status in the Dalit community. An Indian journalist reported rumors that Mayawati had blocked the temples because she wanted only one Dalit goddess in the state. After she left office in 2012, Prasad hoped construction of the temple might resume. It didn't. 5 years later, Uttar Pradesh elected Yogi Adityanath, a monk and a Hindu nationalist from the Bharatiya Janata Party, as its new chief minister, and the prospect of a shrine to English may have dimmed further. The Bharati Janata Party, or BJP, has ruled India since Narendra Modi took power in 2014. The third of a tea seller's six children, Modi is a departure from the pedigreed English-speaking bureaucrats who governed India for most of its post-independence history. He rejects the secular, hyper-diverse vision of the country set forth by Gandhi and Nehru, and has been intent on reshaping India into an explicitly Hindu nation. Language has been central to that project. English is depicted as a symbol of the country's imperialist past and disconnected elites, while Hindi, the Sanskrit-derived language of the masses, has been recast as an avatar of common identity, despite the fact that only about 40% of Indians speak Hindi or one of its many dialects. Although Prasad disagrees with the ideologues of the BJP about the proper place for English in India, they all agree that English is powerful. Putting aside the economic opportunities it unlocks, they see the language as a psychosocial force, one that is rooted in its foreign origins, and that, rather like Hinduism's divine triumvirate, can create, sustain, or destroy social orders. Bourdieu's suggestion that the spread of English represents a form of cognitive hegemony is one that Prasad and the BJP accept, whether as a blessing or as a curse. Yet we can attend to the recent research into cultural psycholinguistics without ascribing so much authority to English. The language is far less unitary than we often suppose. The version of English that the BJP seeks to weaken differs considerably from whatever the British first imposed some two centuries ago. It's a language enamored with the progressive tense, as in, I am going to school every day, whose pronunciation is transfigured by retroflex consonants, say dog, but curl your tongue back until it resembles a fishhook, an unaspirated voiceless plosive, say kick, without expelling air, and in which kindly do the needful and prepone your meeting to tomorrow itself, nah, is a typical request. Honorifics like ji, sir, and sahib are mobilized to accommodate local nuances of deference. After centuries spent fermenting in the subcontinent, English has turned Indian. Such local reworking is ubiquitous. In Singapore, English bred with Malay, Tamil, Hokkien, and other Asian languages to produce that law-filled tongue known as Singlish, a Creole that non-local English speakers struggle to follow. 7 years ago, the BBC began offering news online in West African Pidgin English, which is spoken by more than 100 million people and influenced so strongly by local African tongues that some linguists consider it tonal. There are countless examples like these in which English scaffolding has adapted to the demands of the cultural heritage of its speakers, from Jamaican patois to talk Pisin of New Guinea. For that matter, few tongues exemplify the ever-evolving nature of language better than so-called Standard English, which, after millennia of conquest, conversion, and commerce, has acquired a vocabulary that is roughly 70% non-Germanic and a simplified grammar that facilitates its spread among adults. Bourdieu was right that linguistic patterns affect us. You're listening to the New Yorker magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Yet going by the best ethnographic and social science research, his fear of brainwashing was overblown. If ways of speaking can alter ways of thinking can alter ways of speaking as well. The dynamic interaction between the two is part of the ongoing story of how we try to make the world intelligible to us and to make ourselves intelligible to one another. Talk about the human conversation. Manveer Singh, an assistant professor of anthropology at the University of California, Davis, has written for The New Yorker since 2022. He is the author of Shamanism, The Timeless Religion. Books, Does Morality Do Us Any Good? Our Basic Sense of Right and Wrong appears to be the product of blind evolution. The hard question is how unsettling that should be, by Nikhil Krishnan. According to the philosopher Hanno Saar, morality hasn't always existed. Unlike science, it had to be invented rather than discovered. Nothing kills your appetite, they say, like discovering how the sausage is made. In the realm of superhero cinema, origin stories explain our protagonist's driving motivations. But in the realm of faith and values, I stopped believing everything the tabloids said after I went on a school trip to the offices of my local paper. Others have grown disillusioned once they scrutinize the early history of their religion as historians, not as adherents. It's harder to keep believing some things once you find out why you believe them. Naturally, I hold slavery to be an abomination and liberal democracies to be better than totalitarian dictatorships. But why? I could draw upon my years of education to tell you it has something to do with my belief in freedom, autonomy, the awfulness of treating a fellow human being as a mere instrument. But a skeptic can point out that I had these convictions before I was ever in a position to articulate a cogent argument for them. The arguments came afterward. They are rationalizations of things I already believed. The unflattering truth, the skeptic might continue, is that my views on slavery simply reflect the moral common sense of the society I was born into. My affection for liberal democracy may come from the simple fact that I grew up in one, surrounded by its propaganda. Who knows what I'd think if I'd been raised as a member of a plantation-owning family in the antebellum South, where abolitionists were regarded as dangerous eccentrics. I used to fancy myself a rational creature who believed things for reasons. Now attuned to the question of origins, I see myself no freer of the nexus of causes than my dog, my cactus, or my tennis ball. And not only me. We can all be viewed as the culmination of history, physics, and biology. Yes, our beliefs about math and the natural sciences are product of a history, just as much as our moral beliefs are. But happily, we have something with which to assess our scientific beliefs. There are lab tests to determine whether Newton's first law holds. The trouble is that there's nothing we can test our moral convictions against, except perhaps against other moral convictions, our own and those of other people. Of course, I think my moral convictions are the right ones. That's why they're my convictions. Maybe all I'm entitled to say, though, is that they happen to be mine, as my tastes happen to be mine. A different childhood, different genes, and you'd find a man with the views of John C. Calhoun instead. When the German philosopher Hanno Saar titled his ambitious new book, The Invention of Good and Evil, A World of History of Morality, Oxford, he made it clear that he sees morality as quite different from science. In his account, morality, that body of judgments about good and evil, the practices that reflect those judgments, and the blame, guilt, and punishment that sustain them, hasn't always existed. That's why it has to be invented rather than discovered. For Sauer, the story of the invention of morality is really the story of the evolution of humanity. The processes that produced our morality are simply the processes that produced us as beings who have this morality, rather than, say, the norms that govern ants and their caste-bound colonies, or wolves in their packs, or the snow leopard in its solitude. To understand ourselves as moral creatures, we have to understand that we're built that way. And who exactly are we in all this? That question can be answered in several ways. We might simply be all human beings, members of the species Homo sapiens, or something much narrower, human beings in the 21st century West, with all the values and behavioral quirks peculiar to us, or something in the middle, human beings in a certain stage of a journey that began a few million years ago, shaped by some combination of physics, biochemistry, neurobiology, and history. The structure of Sauer's book reflects this ambiguity, dividing itself into sections that focus on distinct stages of human evolution as he draws on research, some of it now well known, from evolutionary biology, game theory, neuroscience, behavioral psychology, and big picture history of the sort done by writers such as Jared Diamond, David Graeber, and Yuval Noah Harari. Sauer isn't the first writer to embark on an ambitious genealogy of morality. The example of Friedrich Nietzsche, the author of the most ambitious such work, makes one expect something similarly dark and unsettling. Curiously, Sauer's tour of the sausage factory, far from leaving him stricken with nausea, seems to have whetted his appetite for the product. To understand why, we might as well follow his example and start at the very beginning. It was 5 million years ago, Sauer tells us, that creatures rather like ourselves have only just evolved from some now extinct ape, started to develop the psychological dispositions that made them capable of cooperation. Unlike the chimpanzees and bonobos in the dense forests around Central Africa, our ancestors had to survive in exposed grasslands. Cooperating for mutual defense against our predators, and for collectively pursuing prey, was our way of compensating for our new vulnerability. Among the dispositions that emerged to help us get along, Sauer writes, was the capacity for altruistic behavior, putting aside the interests of the individual in favor of a greater common good. Sauer enlists the thought experiment proposed by the American anthropologist Sarah Blaffer Hardy to bring out the distinctiveness of the human capacity for cooperating. Compare how human beings typically behave when flying, crammed together among strangers, silent and motionless, with how chimpanzees might act in the same condition. There'd be pools of blood on the carpet, torn ears, fingers and penises, countless dead apes throughout the plain, and great howling and gnashing of teeth, Sauer writes. None of this tells us that non-human apes can't cooperate. It does suggest, Sauer continues, that we may be unique in how we do it. More flexibly, more generously, with more discipline and with less suspicion, even with strangers. As our environments changed 500,000 or so years ago, and our groups grew larger, we developed the useful new practice of punishment. In evolutionary terms, this was enormously significant. A species that kills its most belligerent, aggressive, and ruthless members over hundreds of generations creates a strong selection pressure in favor of peacefulness, tolerance, and impulse control, Sauer argues. We are the descendants of the friendliest. These friendly apes were not so friendly that they gave up on their newly acquired punitive psychology. They had some version of sentiments and customs we still recognize, blame and shame. But they also began to develop habits of trust and mistrust that enabled them to make good use of information and skills bequeathed by previous generations. So far, things were relatively egalitarian. Then 5,000 or so years ago, after agriculture spread and prehistory gave way to history, hierarchies emerged, dividing our societies into groups, the socioeconomic elites and everyone else. As things became more unequal, we developed a paradoxical aversion to inequality. In time, patterns began to appear that are still with us. Kinship and hierarchy were replaced or augmented by cooperative relationships that individuals entered into voluntarily, covenants, promises, and the economically essential contracts. The people of Europe, at any rate, became what Joseph Henrich, the Harvard evolutionary biologist and anthropologist, influentially termed weird, Western, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic. Weird people tend to believe in moral rules that apply to every human being and tend to downplay the moral significance of their social communities or personal relations. They are, moreover, much less inclined to conform to social norms that lack a moral valence or to defer to such social judgments as shame and honor, but much more inclined to be bothered by their own guilty consciences. That brings us to the past 50 years, decades that inherited the familiar structures of modernity, capitalism, liberal democracy, and the critics of these institutions, who often fault them for failing to deliver on the ideal of human equality. The civil rights struggles of these decades have had an urgency and an excitement that sour rights makes their supporters think victory will be both quick and lasting. When it is neither, disappointment produces the identity politics that is supposed to be the essence of the present cultural moment. His final chapter, billed as an account of the past 5 years, connects disparate contemporary phenomena, vigilance about microaggressions and cultural appropriation, policies of no platforming as instances of the punitive psychology of our early hominin ancestors, our new sensitivities along with the 21st century terms they've inspired, mansplaining, gaslighting, give us as we begin to scrutinize the symbolic markers of our group membership more and more closely and to penalize any noncompliance. We may have new targets, Sauer said, but the psychology is an old one. Sauer, who cautions that his chronological arrangements shouldn't be taken too literally, terms the results of his multidisciplinary triangulation a deep history, one that doesn't use dates or names, sketching out instead a feasible scenario that could have gone along these lines. But his approach does lead him to conclude that there are universal moral values that all people share with each other. Thinkers who see morality as having been constructed are often supposed to have trouble accounting for the possibility of moral progress. What is progress, after all, if not swapping error for a timeless truth? The anxiety induced in us by genealogical reflection comes, in large part, from having to accept that what we'd taken to be an eternal verity might be a fairly recent product of human history, biological and social. If our moral commitments don't rest on deeper truths, how can we hope to resolve the conflicts to continue to divide us? Sauer's perspective here is notably sunny. He sees a possible future in which our values do not so much converge as reveal themselves never to have really diverged in the first place. In reality, it is simply not true that, at the most fundamental level, different cultures have different values, he argues. Widely shared values, as revealed by the World Values Survey, includes personal safety and freedom, care and tolerance, happiness, autonomy, and self-fulfillment. Distracted by our seeming divisions, he writes, we can forget the fundamentals. We all share the same history of morality. Our political disagreements are often shallow. Underneath them are deep-seated, universal moral values that all people share with each other, and that can be the basis for a new understanding. Can such optimism be justified? Other genealogists of morals, notably Nietzsche, doubted that moral beliefs could long retain their grip after we'd learn how they arose. Nietzsche's genealogy, needless to say, was a more impressionistic affair and didn't reach back to any evolutionary savanna. Instead, he was interested in the shift from the values of antiquity, focused on heroism, worldliness, power, to those of the Christian early Middle Ages, focused on humility, renunciation, compassion, and sin. For Nietzsche, the shift was almost entirely to be deplored. The older ethics, a master morality, had been replaced by something, a slave morality. Motivated principally by the hatred, resentment, self-assertion, and wishful thinking of the slaves, who sought to transform the necessities of their situation into virtues. It's no surprise that the meek of the world were drawn to a philosophy that promised them that they would inherit the earth. If Nietzsche was right, altruism comes from selfishness, humility from arrogance, love from hate. And the success of the moralization process was to be found in the fact that it made these tawdry underpinnings invisible. Exposing these origins, in turn, was bound to sap our faith in the modern ideology of good and evil. The question is whether the pedigree that Sauer lays out will prove less discomfiting. In the cold light of day, he asks, will the uncomfortable truth shatter our confidence in our values? Will it show that our morality can stand up to closer scrutiny? He plainly thinks it can, or at least that quite a lot of our morality will survive, and indeed that understanding its origins may actually strengthen our confidence in it. In taking this attitude, he disclaims the hyperbolic polemics that are part of Nietzsche's own entertaining but bad habits, and chooses instead the optimism of a very different thinker, the 18th century Scottish philosopher David Hume. Take an institution that demands absolute allegiance to its laws, such as the nation state. People throughout history, especially those who have been the targets of state violence, have wondered whether we owe this entity our allegiance at all. One way to answer the question, why obey the law, is to explain why the law exists in the first place. To address the question, what's it for? Hume saw that the question could be asked with equal force about the moral law. It was perfectly reasonable to inquire after the point of it, to try to figure out its function. But unlike Nietzsche, he thought that doing so was unlikely to turn us against it. Hume's strategy was to invite us to imagine a world before morality, or specifically before human beings came to value such qualities as justice or to care much for property rights. We were to suppose that human beings in these very ancient times had a basic psychology much like ours, self-interested but capable of sympathy, and needs much like ours, to be fed, housed, and protected from random violence. Should we be surprised that they would have come up with something like the concept of justice, that is to say, principles setting out who owes what to whom? Surely it was only natural that they would count it a good thing if you were the sort of person who told the truth, kept your promises, paid your debts, didn't take other people's stuff without asking, and did your share of the dishes. One might say that the concept of morality here is a construction, or that, as Hume put it, the virtue is artificial. But so what? Artificial doesn't mean unreal or without authority. The rules of morality, even as Hume conceived of them, are no less real or authoritative than other things we have also made up. Traffic lights, norms of etiquette, the principles of grammar. Discovering that the rules in question are there for a reason, far from shattering our respect for their authority, may serve to reinforce it. Stories like Sauer's are inheritors of Hume's confidence. The point of these evolutionary narratives is not to show morality to be in any serious way problematic. It's to show that morality has a function. Sauer accordingly enlists the evolutionary history of morality on behalf of what, in much of the 20th century, seemed a quaint and outmoded notion, moral progress. There seems to be mechanisms between the generations that have the potential gradually to improve human morality, he writes. Progress is always possible and often tangible. Sauer wrote his book in German, Joe Heinrich's English translation preserves the deadpan quality of the prose, but it is not in any stereotypical way Germanic. Much of the book's bibliography consists of works in English, and the book he cites as authoritative are nearly all recent works in psychology and the social sciences. He finds little to interest him in imaginative literature or theology. Sarah's optimism seems almost to be intended as a rebuke to the dour ideal of intellectual seriousness that runs from such canonical thinkers as Arthur Schopenhauer in the 19th century to Theodore Adorno in the 20th. Still, toward the end, he briefly entertains some challenge to his expectation of halting but reliable moral progress across the generations. The conditions in which our morality evolved, he notes, equip us well for cooperation within small groups. But how can we orchestrate cooperation on a scale that encompasses all of humanity and includes generations living far into the future? The challenge of climate change is one of the several we face now that show the problem to be more than theoretical. His answer is equivocal and sits uneasily with the optimism that has preceded it. This is the first time we have faced this task. We do not know if we are capable of doing it. The note of uncertainty is welcome in a text marked by its confidence in cutting-edge evolutionary biology and social science. To be sure, the curtains are soon drawn on this less inspiring view. Sauer's tone of reassurance prevails, grounded in the thesis that our divisions rest on a more or less shared moral system. We've been wrong to worry that morality lacked foundations. The facts on which moral judgments depend are not themselves up to us. We can't choose not to be social animals, nor could we decide tomorrow to adopt the social structures and psychologies of the bumblebees or the Arctic fox. Although Sauer's picture of morality has no room for moral facts as God's law, it finds another respect in which they might be objective nonetheless. The ethical facts are what they are because we are who we are. If some societies weigh our shared values differently, he says, that's because of socioeconomic differences and not radically divergent morals. The same is true, he suggests, for polarization within societies. It's simply a matter of group identities, assuming outsized importance. We don't disagree, we just hate each other. Given the basic psychological structures we've all inherited, he contends, there is an underestimated potential for reconciliation that is hard for us to see, but which may be sustained by a silent majority of reasonable people who reject the ideological extremes. The book ends with a vision of feverish discord and hatred replaced by a feast of calm and community. Evidently, we can put aside our superficial moral differences and reach these sunlit uplands by reminding ourselves of how we came to have the values we have. Will the story do the trick? Several ancient epics would be a lot shorter if all it took to reconcile the feuding brothers was a reminder of their shared lineage. Unfortunately, our origin stories don't tell us how to resolve any particular ethical dispute. The essence of such disputes, as with the fratricidal wars of the ancients, is that they are between factions who share the same psychology, the same history, the same aspirations. The history that made us into creatures capable of cooperation also gave us the capacity to hate one another in the aggregate, to draw sharp lines dividing the in-group from the out-group. Sauer's book may cast a gloomier light than he acknowledges. Our capacity for endless conflict may be just as much a part of our inheritance as is our ability every now and then to get along. In Sauer's final chapter, which deals with the moral or moralistic developments of the past 5 years, one can find some reasons for pessimism. In the standard picture of moral progress, popularized by philosophers such as Peter Singer, Morality advances when we expand the circle of our concern beyond the narrow original in-group of family or clan. The welfare of human beings from other tribes and nations starts to count too. We even begin to extend our moral concerns beyond the human, newly troubled at the thought of factory farms that made possible the cheap burgers on which we cheerfully gorged. Yet that vaunted expansion itself creates a new outgroup, the deplorables, who say persist in voting against greater immigration or who won't sit quietly and eat their tofu. In other words, we learn to define the outgroup, the people we don't have to care about, rather than the orcs in a fantasy video game, by its moral phalanx. The in-group is diverse in terms of race and gender, but morally homogenous. It wasn't so long ago that American progressives on social media weighing in on the hashtag pandemic of the unvaccinated would occasionally betray a grim sense of satisfaction that the Red Country orcs were getting their comeuppance. Does that mean that real moral progress can come only if we give up on moralism? That's too easy. When the much-derided moralism of our times relaxes, the newly emancipated deplorables will focus their ire on the do-gooders of the previous generation, their detested outgroup. Some visions of moral progress look forward to a world in which the in-group-outgroup distinction has vanished. The real lesson of Sauer's genealogy may be that we're just not built that way. Nikhil Krishnan is the author of A Terribly Serious Adventure, Philosophy in the War at Oxford, 1900 to 1960. We are at the conclusion of this week's The New Yorker magazine program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Thank you for tuning in this week, and I invite you to join me next week for another new edition of The New Yorker magazine. Have a great week, and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.